Good afternoon.
Afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you doing? Today is May 14th, 2008, and I'm now sitting with Mr. Joseph C. Kekula, who is the former Inspector General of the Liberian National Police. We are at the Mamba Point Hotel, the terrace, and in Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. Well, first, thank you for your time. And before we start the interview, I'd like you to please confirm that you've given your consent to the interview.
Well, sure. I mean, I've consented. That's why I'm here and ready to proceed.
All right. Well, first, I'd like to learn a little bit more about your personal background. Particularly how the history of how you joined the police and your career within the Liberian National Police.
Okay, thank you very much. In 1977, precisely August, I went to the Liberian. At that time it was Public Safety Institute where the police training was conducted. And I went through the regular policing courses, and upon the completion, I specialized in VIP protection. Then I started work at the presidential mansion during the regime of the late President William R. Talbot. And, I worked at a mansion and went through all the ranks. At that time, colonel was the highest rank, and became a colonel. And I went into exile in 1997 when President Taylor took over and returned in 2003, when I came back, having had a lot of experience for so many years, I was appointed as a deputy director for administration of the Liberian National Police. Therefrom, after 1 year.
That was during the transition government?
Yeah, during the transitional government, 2003. Thereafter, I was appointed as the acting director. Actually, we were the one who changed the ranking system and decided to have inspector general instead of director. But before then, the head of the Liberian National Police was a director. Maybe later on, in the interview, I might tell you the reasons why we had to change the nomenclature from director to inspector general.
Or you can explain now if you want.
Yeah. One of the major reasons that we had to do that was because if you travel through all the English-speaking countries in the sub-region, and the entire region, you find out that we were the only country using the word director for the head of the police. And being that we are participating in regional security, we always find ourselves different when we meet other people. So we decided, well, in order to harmonize our system with the entire region or the sub-region, it's better that we change the nomenclature. And besides, also we look at the ranking system, which was not unified. Because at the time, police were carrying military rank, civilian ranks, and all kinds of ranks. So we decide, well, if we are to reform the police system, we cannot just do window dressing. Let's do it in totality. So So then we brought in the new ranking system that confirms to other countries around us. So that was the basic reason why we, and fortunately for us, the idea was brought before the UN police. They saw that it was a good idea, and then we went through the rule of law implementation committee, and then from there we went to the chairman who was heading the government, and this was accepted, and we had an executive order to back it, because you cannot just do anything without backing from law. You know, and the executive order permitted us to use the ranking system for a period of 1 year, and after that, it should have gone through legislation, but I'm not sure whether that had been done, even though we are no longer there.
Did the changing in the ranking system imply also like a reduction in the number of rank, consolidation of ranks, or no?
Yeah, well, what actually happened is that, like we did this, it actually helped, because firstly, the police was somehow militarized. You know, after the coup in 1980, policemen started carrying military ranks, you know, in order to be on par with the military people at that time. You have lieutenant, you have sergeant, you have majors, you know, colonels. The only rank, military rank we never had was a general, you know. So it reduced the number of ranks, and then it helped us to demilitarize the police. The former ranking system had the propensity to make police feel and behave in the form of the same as the military men, you know. So we sat down long time and said, if we're going to help the people to think that they're not military people and they are police people, they must have something distinct from military people. They can't be carrying the same rank. Psychologically, that is not correct. So that was the reason why we brought that suggestion.
So that was one of the first measures you took when you were appointed director for operations. So maybe you can go through now through the history of Take Back when you were appointed, and sort of like the major phases maybe in your. And your work since you returned to Liberia?
When we took over, actually we found out that the entire system was not very well organized administratively, because we had people who were working with the police that were not even on payroll. You know, they call them volunteers. And the entire situation was just such that you could hardly account for the people. You know, there was no way to account for people. So one of the things that we did was firstly to reduce the unwanted number of people that were just floating around. You know, everybody carrying themselves as police officers, whereby most of them had never even gone for training and were just around. They could do anything, and it would reflect on the police. We took over a police that was that had a very bad reputation as far as the public was concerned. And so,
what was the role of the police during the time of the war and during the period 97 to 2003? What was the police doing? Were they on duty or not? They went home. Some participated in the conflict.
Yeah, they were there. The police were there before we came 2003, but they had different groups within the police. For instance, they had a a special group that was directly responsible to the president, who gave them instruction and they carried out orders directly from him. You know, and the police was used to reward some of these fighters who fought for the president, and just without training, just put them in there, and they all were just there.
Which, what was the name of the unit that was serving the residents?
I'll get to the name later.
Okay.
But let's just continue with the interview.
Sure.
So we try to reduce the number of the people, because it was like the whole place was just crowded with people who were doing nothing, and would go on their own without instructions, because they were not, some of them were not attached to special units, you know. And even though they were not on payroll, but whatever they did outside reflected on the police. So we thought it wise that the first thing is that it's wrong to have people working and they cannot get paid. That is against the laws of this country. You can't have somebody working and you don't pay them. So we first stop that particular group from working. And then we again realized that we had a whole lot of people who came to take pay but were not coming to work. So we tried, by all means, we reduced the payroll by about 600. 600 police officers were not coming to work. So we put up notices for them to come and report to work. They refused to come. And after some time, we just fired them. You know? So
how did you do this? You went around to all the police stations to check the records?
Yeah. The system is that every month, all the police stations sent in their report. All the zones and depots sent in report every month. And then you look at the attendance, those who report to work, you know, they send it to personnel, and then personnel section will do the analysis and submit to the office of the administration. So through that, we're able to establish those who were not reporting the work. And that brought a whole lot of talks. Out of town, they will call me, and some of them will call and threaten me, you know, you fired us, you know, we are the one who fought for the country when some of you were not here, and it is our right to be on the payroll, you know. So, but we didn't mind that, you know, so we took those steps to make corrections, you know. And then after that, we had meetings constantly with the UN police when Mr. Cracker was still here. And we worked very hard with them to put in some kind of system, you know, because if you met a police force that you have to administer, and you inherited a whole lot of ills. There are no set policies, you know, to guide you to do things. And for instance, detention, you know, people will detain people without proper record, you know. So we had to go along to provide those policies, detention policy, administrative policy, you know, how people should report to work. I mean, a whole lot of things, along with the UN police, we had to work together. So we set up a committee that worked both with the UN and Liberian police. That were helping us with the change management, you know, because this was the time that we had to change things around. We are doing the reform, So we had a change management committee comprised of both UN and Liberia National Police, and we gave them specific responsibilities, most especially whenever we had meetings and came up with some things that needed to be changed. They went and looked at it and formulated some procedures through which we could go with the changes, you know. So that helped us a lot, because once you are making changes and you do not know how to manage these changes, what to do, you know, sometimes you have flashbacks that you might not be able to handle easily. So we actually had to put that committee in place, and it was very, very helpful, you know. And after we put the change management in place, they came up with a recruitment policy, how to go about, you know, doing the recruitment, how to do the vetting, you know, and the guidelines, the specific guidelines for the vetting and all of that. And so we were able to follow those guidelines. We started vetting within. We said, well, before we go out there to start recruitment, let's vet those who are working presently within the police. So we started a vetting process.
So how many, so you said you already crossed out 600 LNPs that were not showing up for work. Yeah. How many were left from the former LNP?
Well, I think we still have over 3,000.
Over 3,000?
Yes.
So you vetted these 3,000 first?
Yes. We first started vetting and then put them in categories. Those who some people were vetted and they could not meet up with the educational standards. Some people, because of the age and tenure of service, you know, so we categorize them, you know, and after reducing substantial number of people, then we then set our target as to how many people we need in the future within a given period of time.
Just to finish with the vetting, sir, was there a vetting also based on previous human rights violations, or did you consult with communities, for instance?
Yes, in the process, we even wrote people's names in the newspapers. You know, wrote people before you were accepted. We wrote, even during the recruitment, when you pass our tests, before we accept you, we put the names in the newspaper for like 1 week all around, and then we put boxes everywhere, suggestion boxes to certain points, because some people might be afraid to come up, but if they can write, they could write, they either take it to the Army headquarters or to the Liberia National Police and just put it in a box if you have something against somebody. You know, there was a particular case when somebody came and accused one of the officers of violating his rights. So in cases like that, what we suggested, if you brought a complaint and we had our internal board investigation, they come up with an investigation. And after the investigation, they bring their whatsoever findings they find, then we can ask you if you want to go to court, you know. Because, like, for instance, this officer that I'm talking about, somebody brought a complaint against him. But then the board of investigation came out that the officer was wrong. But the officer took exceptions and said that, in fact, some of the members of the board were against him for personal reasons. So he did not accept it. He wanted to go to court. And so we sent him to court, and then the complainant could not show up, you know, at the court. So in such cases, what do you do? The man brings the case and he cannot follow up to court. So we just had to forget about the entire case, you know. So we did not only do the vetting by ourselves, but we put new papers, we put the names in the papers so that the public could bring their opinion on these individuals.
With any pictures put in the papers? Pictures of the...
No, we did not put pictures. We put the names, you know, and the addresses. Besides that, we also had a team, background investigation team. So if you came up and say you are Mr. This, we send people to go and do your background investigation. If you say you're a high school graduate, they go and check with the school that you say you're from. If you say you live in this community, they go in that community and ask questions about you. You know, so we did all of that in order to complete our duty. It's a long procedure, but it pays out in the long run. You know.
How long did it take to vet the 3,000 men?
The men we vetted, we took almost close to a year.
And of the 3,000, how many were left after the vetting?
I think a little over 1,000 were qualified. So now you see that most of the police officers now are new. More than 75% are new. Because we had a target to augment the strength to about 3,500.
How was the target drawn? How did you decide?
We estimate the population and then try to set a standard, like maybe take a ratio, like for instance, the percentage of population, how many persons to one police officer. Because we estimate our population to be between 3.5 to 4 million. Okay. Over 15 years, we have not had population census. You know. So through that, we came up with a figure of 3,500. Yeah. So this is how we came up with the target.
And so then after this 1 year process of vetting, there was also, you mentioned, a recruitment policy that was drawn at the same time.
Yeah.
What did the recruitment policy consist in?
Yeah, well, the recruitment policy was mainly about what you're supposed to do during the recruitment, how you go about it, you know. If you go in the community, before you go in the community, how you should, the manner in which you communicate with the entire community, and then when you go in the community, the people that you're supposed to contact, you know, like the community leaders, get them involved, you know, to a certain extent, you know, so because if you went in a certain community, before you can really know who is good or who is bad, you have to make some consultations. So the recruitment policy helped to guide us how to do this recruitment.
So once you finish the vetting of the existing one, do you start recruitment for new candidates?
Yes. Well, when we got through with the vetting, we retrained we started the training. In fact, we were doing the training and the vetting simultaneously, because as the vetting was going on, you can't train everybody at the same time. When you get a number of persons, let's say 150 at a time, that's for one set of students you send them to the academy. Because the academy was arranged in a way that it would hold almost up to 600 persons. You know? But then the training is like 10 months of training. So first you start with 150, then additional, after the first 3 months, you send additional 150. Just continue adding until they reach 600. Every 3 months, you graduate 150, then you add additional 150. You put in 150. Every time you graduate 150, you put in additional 150. So it just goes in the cycle.
What were the main novelties in the training, the curriculum, compared to what had been done before, maybe?
Well, some of the main new ingredients in the curriculum were like emphasis on human rights, you know, and the new curriculum put a lot of emphasis on human rights. More than the first curriculum, because before we took over, we heard about a lot of human rights violations by the police, and that's why we set up this criteria of all those who were involved in human rights violation. When we find out that you really were, you will not become part of the new police, you know. So the new curriculum put more emphasis on human rights.
And the new curriculum was drawn in collaboration with UNPOL?
Yeah, UNPOL drew the new curriculum, and then the change management committee was composed of both UNPOL and the Liberia National Police.
Reviewed it and approved it.
They do the work and send it over to us. Mike Cracker will have a copy, I will have a copy, and we look at it, whatsoever input we have. Then after our input, then we take it to the Rule of Law Implementation Committee. The Rule of Law Implementation Committee was comprised of the UNPOL Police Commissioner, the deputy SRSG, who was then Mr. Beyonce, then the Minister of Justice, and then the National Security Advisor, who is directly at the office of the President. So we all used to meet weekly, you know, to review all the operations of the police every week. So the Rule of Law Implementation Committee served as the most high body, you know, in making reform decisions. You know. Thereafter, we just take it directly to the President and have a meeting with him. You know.
So who were the trainers at the time in the Police Academy?
The trainers were mainly people who were mainly UNPOL and few Liberians, LNP officers who were identified by UNPOL. UNPOL, because according to the CPA, the CPA was a comprehensive agreement that was drawn in Ghana. Yeah. So according to the CPA, the UMPO were responsible for the training, you know, and reforming of the new police, of the Liberian National Police. But we couldn't just sit by because the UMPO do not know the culture of this country. They are strangers, so they couldn't do things without consultation. So we work closely with them to carry on the reform.
So just to clarify, in 2003, when the Comprehensive Peace Agreement is signed, you were appointed as a
Deputy
Director for Operations.
For Administration.
For Administration.
Yeah.
The Inspector General is also appointed.
Well, at that time, Mr. Masakoi, Chris Masakoi, who is now Immigration, Christian C. Masakoi, was the Director of Police.
And he was also appointed?
Yeah, he was also appointed by the transitional government, yes.
Were there any other positions that were appointed by the transitional government? Or how was the top management of the police at that time?
Well, the entire top management was appointed by the transitional government because there were the police, the chief, the head of the police, the director, the deputy director for administration, and the deputy director for operations. Even the assistant directors were all appointed.
Were they mostly former police?
Well, not exactly. Even though at a lower level, some people came in that were not former police. But the deputy, the director himself, Chris Masakoi, worked with the police long ago, even though he went into exile. Then myself, then the deputy for Operation Chroma, he worked with the police for a very long time. And all the other people were police products, except for I think one fellow who was brought in by Lloyd.
By what?
By Lloyd, one of the factions, you know. Besides that, everybody else have gone through the regular police training.
So the minimum standards for recruitment at that time were
a high school graduate. Level. You had to graduate from high school, and you have to have no bad human rights records, and you had to be above 18 years, you know, and the entire criteria is there, you know.
As part of the, so the change management committee was where all the discussions over reform and restructuring was happening. Was there discussion over the integration and amalgamation of some of the services within the security sector at the time?
Well, that discussion was not heard by the change management. In fact, we discussed it before in a committee, the Rule of Law Implementation Committee, but the president preferred to leave that to an elected government. He preferred to leave that with an elected government. Because those were legal issues, because most of these bodies were established by statute, so you just can't go and do automatic changes. You have to go through law, the legislation, and all of that.
What were some of the other major internal management issues, challenges that were identified at the time?
Well, there were many challenges those days. As I told you, we inherited a police that was not professional. So we were kind of trying to professionalize the police, you know. And in fact, we had to, when we took over, there were a lot of challenges because there were no equipments to operate with at the beginning. We never even had a car. I used to walk to work, you know. For several months, I walked to go to work. And at some point, we were able to receive some vehicles, even to get the gas for the vehicles was sometimes a very serious problem. So there were a lot of challenges, you know, a lot of operational challenges. And sometimes we had to improvise, you know. Sometimes we have the men go on patrol, foot patrol, you know, because if you just sit there and say, oh, no vehicle for everybody to go, everybody can go in patrol vehicles. So, but we face a lot of challenges, especially equipments, uniforms, no uniforms, you know. Only later on that some donors started coming in, you know. We also decided to because of the frequent problems that we used to have with demonstrators, you know, we decided to have a police support unit. We established a police support unit, which we envisioned would be armed, you know, to help with violent crimes, you know. So we took a 300 men were re-vetted and sent to Nigeria to take the training at the training base of the Nigerian Foreign Police Unit training base. Traveled with them personally and visited that area. And then, but then when they came back, we were in the process of arming them. And then I personally went to Nigeria and requested for them to supply us some firearms. You know, being under sanction, the United Nations had to approve for the arms. We wrote communications to the Rule of Law Implementation Committee, and then that communication was forwarded to the chairman, Chairman Bryan, then, and then both he and the SRSG wrote New York, and the approval was given. The conditions under which this thing would be possible, they gave us some conditions that we had to meet with, and that process was ongoing when we were removed from the place.
So this police support unit, you said, was selected and trained to deal with the issues of riot control. That was right before the elections.
That was right before the elections. You know, we used to have a lot of demonstrations around here. Former combatants, former AFL soldiers, and sometimes even civil servants. You know. A lot of demonstration all the time. So, and besides that, this armed robbery and a lot of violent crimes, you know. So that's against that background, we asked the Nigerian government through our own government to help us train the 300 men. So the United Nations helped us. They provided the plane to take them there, and took them there, they took the training, and we brought them back. I think it's the same group now that is, because when we left from there, the administration that took over from us, I mean, did not carry out the plan as we decided to plan. But right now, since recently there have been a lot of armed robberies all around, I think they are trying to regroup the same people, you know, to arm them, because those arms that we requested for from Nigeria have arrived. Okay. I think right now the police is armed now, should be armed by now. This is.
So, at the time you were already acting director, right? When does the transition happen between being director for operations and acting director general?
What?
When does the transition, you said you were appointed in 2003 as director of operations, and then when does the transition happen that you become director?
That's the time I told you, I think you acted as director for like, for a little over 1 year. I was appointed as deputy for administration in 2003, November 2003. You know? Then in 2004, it was in 2004 that I was appointed as director, acting inspector general.
Inspector general?
Yeah.
When Chris Masakwa
left? Yeah, when Chris Masakwa left. I took over.
You had to?
When Chris Masakwa left, I took over.
Okay.
Yeah. I took over from Masakwa.
One of the major issues of the police has been, as you were describing, the public perception in relation with the public.
Yeah.
What was done during your time to try to improve the accountability of the police and
what we did to improve our relation with the public, we brought in this community policing, wherein we established forums in many communities, you know, that we had meetings with them to tell them what the police were doing and how they could work together with the police to help reduce crimes in their areas. And I think the community policing helped a lot, you know, to regain some of the lost image of the police at the time. Yeah, but I don't know how much right now they are carrying on the community policing. But at that particular time, it became a very big thing in the whole country. You know, because every police unit we had a community policing unit attached to every depot, every area, and we had a community policing forum all around most of the communities, you know. So that helped us a lot.
Another issue has been the depolitization of the police force.
What?
The depolitization of the police force.
Yeah.
You described the use under the Taylor administration and what of some units of security for political purposes.
Mm-hmm.
How was depolitization?
What happened is that when we took over, it's like every administration depends on the style of the administrators. You know, the interim government at the time, the transitional government at the time, was not the kind of government that could misuse the police or use the police for political purposes. Because if you saw that the situation at that time, you know, were under the microscope, the entire world was focused on us, the UN, the CIA, everything that we do, you know, it was in collaboration with the United Nations. They had offices right in the police headquarters, you know, and then we all worked together. We receive advice from them, they receive advice from us, you know, in most of the critical issues, you know. So
you supervised, you were the head of police during the 2005 elections?
Yes.
Right? Yes. How did the issue of politicization play in the elections, and how did the election generally go from a police perspective?
Well, from the police perspective, that was one of the major things that I was very happy about, because we put in the plans, I mean, the plans that we put in were so good to the point that we were able to cover every precinct, election precinct in the country. And that helped us a lot. We had men assigned to every precinct, then we had investigators, you know, assigned with vehicles, you know. Like every county, we had two teams of investigators, so that if there was a problem in any place, these people will be informed, and then they will go straight to the problem area. So, and they worked so well, there were no incidents of violence throughout the country because the police were present everywhere. That was one of the things that really made me happy. I felt that I succeeded because we carried out the elections so peacefully, and that made me happy. Yeah.
So, immediately after the results of the elections are come out,
yeah.
Then what's the situation?
Well, when the result of the elections came out, then we became more engaged planning the security for the inauguration. You know, along with, we had a lot of meetings that went, because during the elections and the inauguration security, all the security had to join together. We had to put, because the LNP alone could not supply the manpower to cover the entire country during the elections. So we got men from all the security agencies, you know, who participated in election security. We had people, even the immigrations and all, were involved in the position of election security. And similarly, during the inauguration, everybody, we had a joint security operation. Everybody participated, and things went on very smoothly. Yeah. So whenever there was an incident whereby we knew that police alone could not handle it, needed more manpower, we called on the other security sectors to join. And so that made things to work in our favor. We never always acted like police were the only one that could do everything. You know?
So after the election, then the inauguration, there's a new government that came in place?
Yes. After the inauguration, the new government came in place, and then they started making appointments. You know?
Changing. Including in the police.
Yes. So things changed. And if you... But I commend this new government, because the changes they made they took most of the people from within, you know, from within who have been there during the reform and restructuring process. And I think only three new people were taken there. But even the three new people, two of them were former police executives, like the present Inspector General. She was deputy director for operations before in the police, before she traveled. The present IG.
Yeah, okay.
You know.
And so she was already in the police?
She was in the police before. You know, she was deputy director for operation before, but she traveled and went to the States.
In exile also?
Yeah. And she was appointed as IG. And then the other fellow too who became first deputy for administration, Al Kale, I understand he was a police officer. He was in the police in Los Angeles, police department. He didn't stay there too long till he was transferred somewhere else. And the present deputy to her was within. She used to work along with us. She was she was the head of our community policy team, you know. And the deputy for operation, Gabriel Tablet, to he a veteran old police officer, even though at the time we were there, he was not with the police, you know. So I think they have a good team. But every time when there is a major change within the police, you take some steps backward, you know, because the present, like all the procedures, all the plans that we made, the new people will want to make their own plans, so they might not be satisfied with some of the things that we were doing. So that brings about a setback. And one of our major aims at the time was to try and professionalize the police. But if you have a force, like right now, most of them are new. Most of the police people are new. So in order for you to professionalize this new group, it takes a lot of work, you know, and a lot of time. Every time if there is a change that affects the plans made by the heads, then you have problem. You have problem. You carry out your plans.
So when the new appointments were made, was there any transition handover period or between the former leadership of the police and the new appointees? How did the transition?
When the new appointments were made, the present IG was out of the country when she was appointed. So I turned over to the deputy who was also appointed newly, who was then Alfred Kale, a young man from the States. When she came, there was a formal program for turning over, but all the other turning over were done before she came in. But Akale was the one who received the entire briefing about our projects, about our plans, you know, because we had our own strategic plan, you know, that we intended to carry out within 5 years, you know. But since we had to leave, We had to turn over the strategic plan and tell them how far we had gone with it, you know. And it was left to them to decide what they wanted to do. When you're running an organization like the LNP, you need to have a strategic plan that guides you for you to know where you want to be within a given period of time. You know? So as you go after a period of time, you go about evaluate what you have done to see whether you are on course, you know. So this is how we would carry on the entire administration. And our colleague took over, we briefly and left. These people are just
we'll cut this here today. Okay.
Yeah.
So the plan was a strategic plan from 2004? A five-year plan?
Yeah, the five-year plan was actually, from 2004. We had a strategic plan before Mr. Masakwa left. We did the plan along with him.
It was 2004, plan, 2009.
Yeah, it was now a plan that I started, you know, it was done by us along with Mr. Masakwa.
So, and after that, when you left office, you went on to
the immigration.
Bureau of Immigration.
Yeah, Bureau of Immigration.
So, when you left the police, you had a strategic plan that was starting to be in place. What were some of the major challenges and some of the key priorities you had identified then for the police?
Firstly, we were on this capacity building the capacity of the manpower, you know, as we had to develop the resources, the human resources first of the police, and then we also were trying to get equipment, you know, because even if you train the men and they don't have equipment, you know, that's a serious problem. And then we asked a lot of friendly nations to help, and most of these requests, some of them materialized mainly when we were out already. Like for instance, the Nigerian assistance they gave after training the men, I asked them to equip the men. Because our plan was to the 300 men to locate them strategically in the country, three different locations, you know, and then because, like for instance, if like Bikana is an industrial city, okay. For instance, if there was a riot in a place like Bikana, and you don't have a group there, I think we need to change this location.
Yeah. Yeah? Well, we'll try to. Yeah, we'll interrupt for a second and start again. This is the second part of an interview with the soldiers.
I was talking about how we intended to use the police support unit. As I was saying, we had decided to deploy them in three locations. So there were 300 of them. You know, so that in case there was a riot in one part of the country, you won't have to always take people from Monrovia before they get there. The damage will be done. So we decided to have them stationed in the central of Monrovia, Liberia, that's in Gbanga, and then another groups in Bikana, which is one of the industrial cities in the country. So we intended to have them well equipped, you know, and then just have a base for them that could have made our work easier. and whenever there was a riot that one group could not continue, at least they would be on the ground while they augmenting their strength with other groups, with the nearest group. So that's how we decided to use that particular group that we treat.
You mentioned the difficulty of the transitional government in bringing about major changes because they were not elected government. Was the security sector, and particularly the police, one of the priorities you felt of the politicians at that time?
The CPA mandated the reform and restructuring of the police. So that was not anything that they had choice over, whether they liked it or not. And the CPA, it was an agreement from Accra, you know. So it was a priority. Police reform, the reformation of the police was a priority. And the document mandated the United Nations to do that. You know, to do the reform and restructuring of the police.
What were some of the underlying political, social, and economic conditions that have made reform easier? This is one, actually, that there was a CPA signed that made the reform easier.
Yeah.
Were there some other aspects that made it maybe more difficult in terms of the context in which it was driven?
Some of the things that made it a little more difficult was that at a certain point, by then we had already left. They found it difficult to get the number of men that were needed, the number of high school graduates that wanted to enter the wanted to be police officers. So as a result, I think they had to reduce the grade. I think to either 10th grade or whatsoever, which to me was not correct, you know, because the law that established the police says high school graduate. You know.
Was it because there were not enough people with high school degrees, or was it because the police was just not attractive enough that people with degrees would apply?
Before we actually left, we tried our best to make it more attractive because, like for instance, we prevailed on the government to increase the police salary, you know, from $15 US to $90 for private.
To increase from $15 a month?
Yes.
To $90 a month?
Yes. And that was done, and that helped a lot to attract people. So even right now, the police is receiving more money than all the civil servants. You know, so the civil servants are receiving $55 right now a month. You know, the police is receiving the minimum of $90. So the police work, we did a lot to impress on the government because the government was very cooperative at the time. The transitional government was very cooperative. They accepted most of our proposals and suggestions.
Were there any innovations at that time, or any major reform changes that you think were particularly successful in the police?
Well, I think we're kind of successful in many ways because, firstly, we were able to change the image of the police was changed completely. police became somehow more community oriented, and we were able to change a lot of perception, negative perception people had about the police. And then we were able to also improve the economic status of the police men themselves, you know. And besides, we were able to weed out a lot of unproductive officers, you know. We got rid of a whole lot of unproductive officers, people who were only there for the namesake and were not doing things that they were supposed to do. So I'm sure we were successful in some ways.
Now the last section, I'd like the return from the local police to the donor community and the United Nations that were heavily involved at that time, because their mandate was because of the CPA to reform and restructure. And I'd like to ask you if there were some, what were some of the positive aspects of working with the UN and donor community, and maybe what were some mistakes that donor countries and international organizations like the UN, with respect to the relationship with the country personnel and the country in general, make?
The relationship with the UN, especially the UN police, was very cordial, I can say, from the top. Even though at the beginning, a lot of people were against the change, you know. It took us a long period of time to make some of these officers to understand that the changes have to go on, whether they like it or not. So at first, we had a lot of opposition from within the police itself regarding the change process. But then when everybody became convinced that it is going to go on, everybody was in line. And with the donor communities, sometimes the process takes too long, you know, and sometimes if they are going to donate something, it takes too long. And for instance, I was there when Mike Cracker was still here, we were working on some very needed supplies, such as vehicles, uniforms, and other things. Believe me, I left from there before some of these things even came. He went far, so many years before some of these things, and sometimes it takes too long. And also sometimes, like for instance, if a donor country agrees to provide certain things, you know, they're going to send it through the United Nations Development Project, UNDP. And sometimes to get those things through those stages might take a very long time. Because sometimes the guy at UNDP might not know the implications, you know. Like for instance, I'll tell you one instance. Since we came up with the new ranking system, a donor country agreed to provide the badges, and the money went to UNDP. And the samples, everything was provided, the companies bid for the supply. I can tell you, up to this time, those badges have not been brought in, you know. So sometimes you find out there are a whole lot of delays. And once the officers do not have the correct badges, you know, the civilians find it difficult to identify who is who. You know, you going with all badge. There's no badge number, no, only maybe the name tag, and not everybody is using it, you know. So these are some of the constraints that, otherwise, you know, things went up pretty well. Even though sometimes when two groups are working, sometimes there are some misunderstandings, but you can quickly get over those things if you have a set plan. You know, both of you have a plan that you are going. You know where you are heading to. If somebody makes a mistake, you can easily correct it. So I think the best thing that we did, along with the UN, was to have a plan, and which was understood by both sides. We knew where we were, and we knew where we were heading to, you know, and who were responsible for what, you know. This way, things were made very clear, because the UN officers knew their responsibilities, and the LNP officers knew their responsibilities, you know. Even during riot control, before you go out there, the UN people know what their responsibilities are, and the Liberian officers know what their responsibilities are. Once you set those things properly in place, you know, even if there are mistakes, mistakes will be minimal, you know. So these are things that helped us a lot.
Well, the UN is still in country, but had already a plan of withdrawing progressively. Now it's the drawdown phase.
Yeah.
I know you haven't been, and now it's been almost 3 years that you left the Liberian National Congress. But in your opinion, based on your experience, what are the biggest challenges that the police will face once the UN and the donors withdraw?
Well, some of the challenges, major challenges they will face will be to be able, because once they, like for instance, some criminals will try to make advances, they will try to challenge to see the strength, because once the UN army is gone, you have the Liberian army in place, which is not fully equipped like the UN army, and then you have the UN police is gone, the Liberian police is there, and they're not equipped, you know. I think the major challenges that the Liberian National Police will face will be equipment, and then building up the capacity of the manpower which they are working on now, you know. And then if we happen to get a result of the census to tell us exactly how many people live in this country, then based on that, they'll be able to either increase the manpower to know how many men they need to cope with the population, you know. And then for the equipment, I'm sure they already know what kind of equipment are needed. The government just has to take over the responsibility to supply them with the needed equipment.
Do you have any final comments reflecting on your time in the police or since you left the police?
Well, the only comments I will have is that in any reform and restructuring situation, I think if you have a good team that is working hard, it's not always good to make abrupt changes, especially that will affect the implementation of the plans that are put on the ground. Like in the situation of Liberia, the political authorities, they never made a lot of changes, you know, to affect the implementation of the plans. Because when we left from there, there were still people within who ascended to certain decision-making levels and were able to advise the incoming heads on the things that we were doing. And most of it were carried out, especially like the number of officers that we wanted to train within the given period of time. You know, all of that was carried out. And the recruitment process, you know, should always reflect the kind of services that you hope the people, those who are recruited, will be rendering. You know, because if you take people who will otherwise, after their training, will not be able to, because there are a lot of people who will want to be police, but they can never be police materials. You know, they will try their best, but in the long run, they just will not make it. You know, so it's always good to have proper planning for your vetting process to do your recruitment. So I think generally everything is okay. Things are coming on fine with the Liberian National Police. I just hope that we'll be able to identify nearly all of the things that we need to do before the departure of the United Nations Police.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, too.